We're back to continue our study of the signs of the times as taught by Jesus Christ in the book of Matthew chapter 24. And we started in that passage and then we've sort of gathered together these signs under a number of headings. In general, we can say that the Bible describes the end of human history as a time of great tribulation. Those are Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 24, 15 and following, is that there will be a great time of tribulation unlike anything the world has ever known. And events that lead up to that are also spelled out in various passages. Now we've been studying, if you've been here the last 2 weeks with us, a number of signs in the area of our ecology. For instance, the overpopulation that we find indicated in Scripture for the last days. And we find that this sign is at hand today in an amazing way, that the human population has spiraled upward. The pollution, the famines that are described and compared to the birth pangs of a woman in labor are now either at hand or more or less guaranteed based on other ecological factors. Last week we studied the issue of pestilence, the gray ashen horse of Revelation. And we saw that to the extent that this sign is perhaps not yet completely at hand, the setup for it certainly seems to be at hand. And we could easily foresee astonishing world plagues once again due to new developments in that year. A final one that's mentioned is seismic activity, great earthquakes, and so on. And this is a sign which, as we look into it in current events today, we find really no evidence that this sign is yet at hand. And so it stands alone as something that has not yet materialized in this particular field. Tonight, we want to speak about some of the political signs that are given to us. The Bible has a lot to say about the politics and the world situation, power structures at the end of human history as we know it. Specifically, the Bible predicts the regathering of Israel. After having been dispersed in a worldwide diaspora, that they will be regathered into their own land again. Then, too, the Bible predicts one worldism, and ultimately that the world literally comes together under a single government for a period of time. The unification of Europe into a 10-nation confederacy that becomes the dominant political and military power in the world. And a great Eastern power that's extremely numerous and has military power capable of destroying a third of the human race. Ultimately, the Antichrist, who is the sort of zenith of the world system, according to the biblical scenario. Let's tear into this. Starting with our first sign that's given, a very key one, the regathering of Israel. Now in Luke 21, we have Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse, and he gives signs also similar to Matthew's. The language is very similar in verse 10 and 11, where he talks about the wars, the plagues, the famines, and so forth. But then he says, but before all these things, and so the chronology is clear that there will be these signs, but before that, namely in the shorter term, some other things will happen. Now when we look back and think back to what it was they asked him that provoked this discussion, in Matthew chapter 24, they asked him two questions. One was, when will these things be, referring to the destruction of the temple? The other question was, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? In their mind, they were the same thing. Yet we now realize these are separated widely in time. And Christ was answering not one, but two questions in this discourse. So when he goes and says, before all these things, he goes to the one question of the destruction of the temple. And that would be the immediate future in his day. This was given 40 years. This was given in 33 AD. And the temple itself ultimately was destroyed in 70 AD. So this is less than 40 years away when he spoke it. He says in verse 20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. This is the answer then to the question, when will these things be? When will the temple be destroyed? He says, then, if you see this, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, in order that all the things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are with child, and those who nurse babes in those days, for there will be a great distress upon the land, and wrath to this people. This people, meaning the Jewish people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all nations. There's the breaching of the siege of Jerusalem, the destruction of many Jewish people, which did occur, and their diaspora into the nations of the world. And then he says, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And so there's this passage of time called the times of the Gentiles, the times of the non-Jews. And he says that Jerusalem will lie in non-Jewish hands during that period. And until that period is fulfilled, and the implication then is clear that at that point it will return again to Jewish hands. Jerusalem, the place to watch. Incredibly, Israel became a nation again in 1948, but they did not have possession of Jerusalem at that time. Jerusalem remained in Arab hands. And then it was only during the Six-Day War in the 60s that Israel finally took possession of the ancient city as predicted. And I remember that. I'm old enough to remember sitting and watching Moshe Dayan coming into the Wailing Wall, and there were millions of Bible-believing Christians all over the world watching that event, sort of with their heart beating, thinking, this is exactly what the Bible said would happen. In the Old Testament, it predicted it in several places. For instance, Isaiah 11, verse 11. Says, then it will happen that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and the islands of the sea. And I left that part in there because this is clearly not referring to the return of the Jewish people from Babylon that occurred at the time that Daniel lived and shortly thereafter, that's recorded in the book of Nehemiah. This is a different diaspora. This is the second time that he regathers them after that, and we find that they're not in Babylon, but they're scattered all through these other countries, including the islands of the sea, which was a term the Jewish non-seafaring people used to describe lands out past the water that we don't know about and we don't visit, the islands of the sea. And it records that God will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth, 750 years before the life of Jesus Christ, this text was written. And we have extremely ancient copies of this text. Here's another one in Ezekiel 37. 1 and following. Ezekiel, a prophet, speaking, says, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of a valley. And it was full of bones. And he caused me to pass among them and around about. And behold, there were very many on the surface of the valley, and lo, they were very dry. In other words, they'd been dead a long time. He said to me, son of man, can these bones live? I answered, O Lord God, you're the one who knows that. And he said to me, prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you that you may come to life. And I will put sinews on you and make flesh grow back on you. I'll cover you with skin and put breath in you that you may come alive and you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a rattling, and the bones came together, bone to bone. And I looked, and behold, sinews were on them, and flesh grew, and skin covered them. But there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. prophesy, son of man, and say to the breath, thus says the Lord God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe on these slain that they may come to life. And so I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they came to life and stood on their feet, an exceedingly great army. Now, I'm suggesting to you that this is a prophecy of the regathering of the nation of Israel, but I'm not reading that in to the text like you would have to make something up and fit it in if you were reading a Nostradamus text or some other spurious prophecy. Here in the Bible, God himself tells us what it means. In verse 11, he says to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Thus says the Lord God, I will open your graves and I will cause you to come up out of your graves, my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I have opened your graves and caused you to come up out of your graves. And I'll put my spirit within you and you will come to life, and I'll place you on your own land. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I'll take the sons of Israel from among the nations where they have gone, and I will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land on the mountains of Israel. This is a prophecy made some 400 years before the time of Christ. And it clearly states that the nation of Israel will be gathered from all nations and brought back to their ancestral land. And he goes on to say, just to fix this in time, when does this event occur? My servant David will be king over them. And they will all have one shepherd, and they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. And that phrase puts this event at the end of human history as we know it, at the time of the return of King Messiah, who is referred to here as my servant David, not the literal King David. He was dead already 500 to 600 years before this was written. But often the son of David is the term for the Messiah, because he was to be in David's line, a king like David on David's throne. And I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it will be an everlasting covenant with them. There will never again be war once David, the son of David, comes to be their shepherd. The regathering of Israel, an amazing prediction, a stunning prediction. Very striking. Think about it. First of all, this event is totally unprecedented in the history of the human race. Many nations have been exiled from their land. There's nothing unusual about that. Ancient conquerors did this to prevent nationalism from rising in a conquered area. So they would drive their people off the land and make them live somewhere else, so they would lose their identity as a people. And this happened to the Jews on two different occasions, with the Babylonians, and then again, the Romans did it not long after Jesus gave his prophecy. As he predicted, they would be led into all nations. The bizarre part about this is that the Jewish people went out, spreading out really into a global diaspora, living in communities for century after century after century. And after 1900 years, as predicted, they came back partly under the shadow of the Holocaust, which drove a lot of the immigration into Israel. Although this return to Israel is still going on in full force in our own day. And in fact, in the past several years, immigrants have moved into Israel than did after the Holocaust from Russia, as Russia has opened its doors to immigration. So millions of Jews have now returned to their land as predicted in the Bible. And nothing like this has ever happened with any other nation. Nothing like it. Unprecedented. What about the claim that, these Bible prophecies, these are just things that happen every generation or so? Not this one. How about the guys in 2 Peter we were reading about, ever since the fathers fell asleep, everything remains as it was. Where is the hope of his coming? Well, this isn't the way it's always been, is it? This is a very unique, one-of-a-kind incident. The predictions are explicit. It really doesn't, it's not a matter of personal interpretation. Now I read through some of these for you so you could see how clear it really is that the Jewish people would be scattered abroad across the face of the earth into all nations and then regathered into the nation of Israel near the end of time. It's real clear, not shady or hard to see. And it's objective, which means, you know, they're either there or they're not there. You don't have to read the tea leaves in the bottom of the cup to find out whether this one came true. And it did come true, and it has been fulfilled. This is a startling sort of kickoff to the prophetic scenario, I think, of the end times. I think when God recalled his people into the land of Israel, I think that the prophetic clock began to tick again that had been on hold. I don't know how anyone could really look at this and not be forced to conclude that we're looking at something very remarkable, very hard to explain in human terms here. And so when we look at the political signs that I mentioned earlier, we find that this first one, the regathering of Israel, behold, is at hand and has been fulfilled. A key beginning point. Wow. Yeah. This brings us then to our second sign, and we want to take a little bit of time on tonight, one worldism. You know, you wouldn't have to go back very far, just within our own lifetime, if you put forward the suggestion that maybe the whole world would get together under one government. that's never going to happen. Still today, it would be possible to look out and say, I don't see that the nations will ever agree. There's over 200 nations on earth. They're not going to ever agree to come under a single government. That's just not going to happen. Well, we live in interesting days. And I'll tell you, the pace of change in the days we live is blindingly fast. Things are happening so quick that if you're not really watching, it's really hard to keep up with events as they develop. And this area of one worldism, I don't see that a government would ever be able to rise up and be so dominant, so powerful, so attractive that just the whole world would follow after it, you know, and go from a state of nationalism and alienation, division, to suddenly wanting to unify just like that. But what I think is much more credible is the idea that one worldism will become an ideology and will permeate the world, and that the world will be desiring this. And then a government will be able to step forward and actualize those one world aspirations. That the idea of having one world will have to be well ingrained. For some reason, people would have to embrace that idea. No government could impose this on the world's population. It just couldn't be done. Unless they wanted it. And the Bible declares that they will. In Revelation chapter 13, verse 7, for example, we find that there is a great government at the end of time which is given authority over every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Four different ways, he says, everybody is going to follow after this great one world government. I think that tonight we see certain trends. We can look out today and see some amazing trends that make this more likely than ever before that this will indeed literally happen. I think we can identify several threads that are pushing the logic of one worldism to the point where it's just going to be almost irresistible. Last week and the week before, we talked about ecological pressure points, and one of the things we saw with the tremendous ecological problems that face the world today is that the solution to these problems must be global. Local solutions simply will not have any effect. And that is a pressure point which, in the minds of those who study the area and who think about it and who worry about it, leads to the conclusion that we need to form a global government. We need to come together globally as a people. Tonight, we're going to bring up a few more threads. including international entertainment. Very interesting concept. Global business, global monetary markets, the information revolution, and weapons technology. Well, we won't get to weapons technology tonight. We're going to handle that later in this series. But all we'll say tonight is, don't think that the nuclear threat has been reduced just because the U.S. and Russia have destroyed some weapons. Now, the nuclear threat is greater today than at any time in our history, according to the authorities that study the subject. And nuclear proliferation is a greater danger and a greater reality today than ever before. But we'll talk about weapons later. Tonight, let's start out, and what I'm going to do on this, we're moving into some areas that are extremely interesting, fascinating developments, I think, and yet most of us are not scholars in business or in information technology. I am not, but the people I'm citing are. What I think we should do, you're not going to be able to take notes on this part. Just sit back, and I'm going to read you some statements again and try to get the feel. And I've gone to about 8 to 10, 12 authorities on most of this material so that you'll get the feel that this isn't just the view of a person here or there, but that this is really what authorities in the field are saying today. The first thing we want to talk about is the international entertainment industry. Entertainment. Quoting here from Barnett and Kavanaugh in their book Global Dreams, Simon & Schuster, 94. Here's what they say about entertainment in the world today. They say, unlike American automobiles, television sets, and machine tools, American cultural products like movies, TV programs, videos, records, cassettes, and CDs are sweeping the globe. And boy, is that ever true. If you've traveled much internationally, you know how true that is. That American culture, pop culture, is a rave worldwide. And they go on to say, in 1990, according to the World Tourism Organization of the United Nations, 429 million people traveled from one country to another as tourists. The democratization of travel is a recent development. The global mass tourist industry, unknown before World War II, when few but the rich could tour, is now the world's largest employer. More people work in tourism than any other thing worldwide. So many people are traveling, and they go on to detail how even in poor countries, they will save and save for years to be able to travel abroad. And it's just becoming worldwide the thing to do, and people are being exposed to cultures other than their own as a result. Ironically, the world power with the greatest investment in the status quo, the U.S., is spreading messages of rebellion among its cultural products. As leading arts critic in Japan puts it, the image of America radiates unlimited freedom. And so, you know, they're watching Schwarzenegger movies and the, you know, just whatever is on that we're watching. The pop music that we're listening to, the alternative music, the rap music, this is the stuff that people are desperate and eager for in other countries. And there's an incredible thirst for the cultural products. And then, of course, you know, what happens is that the ideology follows along with it. And that ideology is largely a freedom-extolling ideology that's virtually antinomian, that's virtually amoral. And other cultures are picking up on this. John Micklethwaite says, entertainment has replaced its most potent rival for human emotion, religion, as the opium for the masses. Entertainment, they say, is filling the vacuum left by the collapse of traditional local-based institutions. And it reflects the radical changes in the ways human beings are interacting across the world. The decline of the traditional family life almost everywhere. The atrophying of civic life and the pervasive loss of faith in politics appear to be a worldwide trend. These guys are business authorities who study these trends, demographics worldwide, and I was amazed at the facts they rolled out to back up their claim. Just as the U.S. has led the world in divorce and in many of the negative cultural features that we're wrestling with here, we're finding that in most countries of the world, those curves are taking off there, following after a trend that we're already well familiar with. And of course, with it go many of the positive things that are a part of our culture, including the belief in personal freedom and the ambition to create and to excel. Popular culture acts as a sponge to soak up spare time, they write, and energy that in earlier times might well have been devoted to nurturing and instructing children or to participating in political, religious, civic, or community activities, or in crafts, in reading, and in continuing self-education. Why, that sure is true in this country, isn't it? I mean, what do people do? They sit around and get entertained. That seems to be the goal of our society, is to be entertained as much as possible. You know, we have the ad where the Generation Xers stand there, been there, done that, had it, savored it. And, you know, that's the ethos of our day, is that, you know, I want to do it all, I'm going to do it all, and boy, you know, I'm just out to have a great time and be entertained to the max. Interestingly, then, this ethos is our biggest export today as a people to the rest of the world. As traditional family ties and the bonds of small-town life weaken almost everywhere, entertainment serves to build new forms of community, but more often it serves as a substitute for community. Think about it. People who lived in backward villages, who were isolated and ingrown in their thinking, move into urban centers increasingly as industrialization spreads across the world, and there, even in, Barnett and Kavanaugh describe how even in the cardboard hovels of Bombay, where for square miles people live in shanties and huts they've constructed out of scrap, jutting up through it all over the place are TV antennas. And that's one thing that even the poorest households manages to somehow get, is a TV. And so these people move into these urban centers and they begin to watch TV and movies. They begin to listen to music and so forth, describing this marvelous, freewheeling, carefree life that we see described, you know, by the swimming pool in a Hollywood mansion. It's the dream that is capturing the minds and the hearts of people all over the world. Most of them will never attain to it. And I wonder, before we go on, I wonder what the impact of that will be. Increasingly, one of the effects it's having is that it is breaking down provincial attitudes and outlooks, and that culture is becoming globalized. Instead of having our culture, which we like and which we don't like your culture, increasingly we're seeing a movement towards sort of a shared culture in the world today. One of the biggest barriers to world reconciliation has always been language and culture. And of course, interestingly, along with the culture of the U.S. comes English, which is becoming the international trade language and the international cultural language. People learn to sing songs, and I've seen this many times in third world countries, people singing songs with English lyrics which they do not understand, but they've learned to mouth them, and they're as eager as can be to learn what they mean and to get to the point where they do understand them. English is sweeping the globe as a second language for just about every nation. These are some of the biggest barriers that have prevented people from ever being willing to consider cooperation. Is that, you know, you're barely human, you don't even speak our language. Well, now we all speak the same language. Global business, a big, big contributor. Boy, has this area been moving fast. Theodore Levitt, professor at Harvard Business School says the products and methods of the industrialized world play a single tune for all the rest of the world, and all the world eagerly dances to it. He says the multinational corporation operates in a number of countries and adjusts its practices in each at a high relative cost. The big movement today is toward what they're calling a global corporation, globalization. The difference being that the global corporation sells the same things in the same way everywhere. The result being that people in India or people in South America or in Africa are not having products brought to them that they're familiar with and with an approach that they're familiar with, but rather they're being brought products that are Western, with an approach that is Western, and being told, take that, and they're taking it. They're into it. This is becoming a grossly successful approach to marketing, more so than diversifying your market approach overly so. There are only minor adjustments made for different countries. Many of the advertisements that we watch on TV here, for Levi's, for instance, those weird Calvin Klein commercials, those real strange commercials, often with few or no words, are viewed all around the world today, the same commercial. And it flies just as well in other countries as it does here. The global expansion of the largest advertising agencies grew with astonishing speed in the 1980s as they convinced clients that cultural diversity was no longer an obstacle to reaching the global customer. For instance, in 1992, the Coca-Cola aired its first truly global commercials. 131 countries, this was during the Olympics, and remember there were several global commercials. One has a blimp flying around the world. Another one has someone batting and this was, I believe, the Coca-Cola one, threw the ball in different countries, and they catch it all the way around the world. Those commercials were made for a global audience. 131 countries, 3.8 billion viewers. Now that's a market for an advertiser. That's an advertiser's dream right there. In 92, CNN reached 78 million homes in more than 100 countries. MTV claims more than 200 million viewers worldwide. And I wish I had our current numbers for you. I don't. These are early 90s numbers. I'm sure they've gone way up in the last 4 years since that was written. In 1970, according to the UN Center on Transnational Corporations, there were 7,000 multinational companies in the world, and more than half of them were based in the United States and Great Britain. But by the early 90s, there were 35,000 multinational companies, and the United States, Japan, Germany, and Switzerland combined had less than half. In other words, this is a phenomena of globalizing corporations that is spreading into all countries, and is, although the U.S. is still the biggest player, along with Japan, it's a worldwide phenomenon. David Corton, in his book, When Corporations Rule the World, Corton is another authority in business from Stanford. He says, from 1950 to 1990, world trade soared from exports of $308 billion to $3,554 billion. These are all in 1990 dollars, so he's controlling for inflation. This is all actual growth. It's an 11.5-fold increase, or more than twice the rate of increase of total economic output. What we're being told here is that trade is moving away from being something that's done within nations and is moving to being something that is done worldwide at an incredible rate. The men who run global corporations are the first in history with the organization, the technology, the money, and the ideology to make a credible try at managing the world as an integrated economic unit. What they are demanding, in essence, is the right to transcend the nation state, and in the process, to transform it. Corton goes on. He says, the past two decades have seen the most rapid and sweeping institutional transformation in human history. It's a conscious, intentional transformation in search of a new world economic order in which business has no nationality and knows no borders. He says, we see the lowering of all economic barriers between North America, Europe, and Japan. Trade barriers, investment barriers, legal barriers, and so forth, in order to begin creating the nucleus of a new world economic order that would include harmonized world business system with the agreed rules and procedures that transcend national boundaries. Here's Silva and Chogrin in their book Europe 1992 and the New World Power Game. They say the world's multinational corporations are evolving into global competitors best described as consortia. Parent companies without national loyalty that own and coordinate business assets in multiple countries. And they go on to detail several of the biggest. They're unbelievably huge. They say in this particular area of international poker, the Japanese hold a pair of deuces, while the Europeans and Americans hold full houses. Sam Kusumoto, the CEO of America's subsidiary of Minolta Camera, comments that, quote, Japan is still 15 to 25 years behind in terms of consortia. And these facts will become important when we study developments in Europe, which the Bible declares is going to have a prominent place in the end times scenario. If IBM, for instance, they said, IBM set forth a growth goal of the next 6 years of $100 billion. They said for them to reach that objective, almost $75 billion of that has to come from non-U.S. markets. Now that gives you an idea, so only a quarter will be from the U.S. Three quarters of it will be from other world markets. And that gives you an idea, they're probably not that unusual in that ratio. Increasingly, corporations are seeing the world as their market, not a particular nation. Since the total volume of stock traded on the Tokyo and the London exchanges already exceeds that of the New York Stock Exchange, current restrictions that limit the sale of stock across national borders will most likely dissolve in the future. They point out that the issue of ownership, legality, and the location of your headquarters, what country your headquarters is located in, raise but three obvious challenges to the balance, the need, or even the wisdom of national loyalty in the future of global economic change. Japanese author and consultant Kenichi Omahe projects a corporate world without borders and even suggests that, quote, national borders are now irrelevant to most companies and consumers. I think it's really interesting. The things we buy and the corporations that bring them increasingly see no use for the concept of the nation state. And they're viewing themselves strictly in global terms. You know, when globalism is an economic reality, how long can it take before it also becomes a political reality? Silva and Chogrin say, one thing is certain. Companies that live or die by the sword of international consumption cannot afford to leave their destinies in the hands of government. They say in the 21st century, the line between trade or economic policy on the one hand and foreign policy will all but disappear, as it already is. Here's Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute. He says in 1947, for example, when the current system of trade laws was established, tariffs worldwide averaged about 40% of the price of each product was a tariff, a tax. Today, they average about 5%. And so we're 1/8 of the tariffs that we used to charge worldwide. And country after country is dropping its tariff barriers because if you have tariffs today, you're going to be left out of the gold rush that's on for world and global markets. And so the push is on worldwide to lower tariffs, to give tax incentives to companies to come in, set up business in your country. global trade of products made by the world's 350 largest transnational corporations accounts for almost 40% of the world's merchandise trade. Yow! That's that $3.5 trillion number. 40% of that is done by only 350 companies. Globalization has transformed the world food industry, to take one example. At every point, the global grain market has become more concentrated in fewer companies. Five grain companies control 96% of all American wheat exports and 95% of American corn exports. The same companies handle 90% of the wheat and corn trade in the common market, 90% of Canada's barley exports, and 80% of Argentina's wheat exports. And of course, Canada and Argentina are big exporters. In other words, there are five companies practically governing most of the grain in the world today. Changes in tax laws and industrial regulation, the elimination of many barriers to border crossings of all sorts, and the orchestration of economic incentives to influence corporate behavior have encouraged the radical reorganization of global production, according to Barnett and Kavanaugh. And this is what this part where I'm talking about how countries are lowering their taxes and saying, we'll give you 15 years tax-free if you come in here and set up a factory. We'll drop all tariffs and so forth. And countries are just wooing international corporations and are prepared to do anything to bring them in. And the result is that to rev the engine of global marketing. The retreat of government in many places around the world has left a power vacuum that corporations have rushed in to fill. Global monetary markets. Here's a fourth strain. Okay, the financial markets, the currency markets in the world, and the monetary markets deal in basically buying and selling money and securities, bonds. And we're finding that there are global trends in this that are totally new and have just arisen within the past decade and a half. Today, well over $2 trillion a day travels across the street or across the world at unimaginable speed as bits of electronic information. By the end of the 80s, underdeveloped countries were paying about $50 billion a year more in debt service to global banks and governments than they were receiving in new loans. The third world is really paying the bill for a lot of this. Information technology also makes it easier to check creditworthiness and to identify the parties to money transfer transactions, even at great distance. But, quote, the speed and anonymity of the global money transfer system presents an important opportunity for large-scale criminal operations and tax fraud. This is one of the big problems that's coming up as corporations and banks shuffle money back and forth internationally. There are literally billions of dollars that travel the globe every day, gaining an increment of wealth at each stop along the way. Kavanaugh and Barnett are quite good in giving examples how even seconds of response time can mean the difference of millions of dollars when you're shuffling those sizes of sums around, and the effort is to meet the markets in each land sort of as the world turns. The result is staggering amounts of capital that are available, but so much of it seems to be non-productive or speculation capital. And of course, who can keep track of the shysters and the no goods that come in and begin to use this system? For instance, in 89, according to the U.S. State Department report, annual worldwide drug profits were estimated to be $110 billion. A year later, banking officials of the leading industrialized nations raised the estimate to $300 billion. That's a lot of money. And they're able to launder and build their money along with everyone else, and it gets harder and harder to control when you're not working within a nation where you have laws and regulations anymore. The rise of global financial markets makes it increasingly difficult for national governments to formulate economic policy, much less to enforce it. You can always get around the law today with the worldwide electronic network that's in place to move money. The global expansion through large corporate mergers, acquisitions, gathered steam in the 70s. And this global restructuring of industry required the amassing of huge amounts of capital. At first, the banks dominated this market. But in the 80s, as capital needs mushroomed, corporations in need of funds found it much cheaper to raise the capital by issuing bonds and other sorts of commercial paper. Essentially, in these bond offerings and various types of futures offerings and stock indexing offerings, companies are creating a form of money. This commercial paper is like an international currency, a money that derives from no country and which can balloon in size internationally. They say thanks to the proliferation of money products through derivative markets like swaps, stock index options, futures, and the like, under current law, regulators cannot keep up with the swoosh of homeless money. Unregulated speculation is a major threat to the world economy, and global regulation is clearly a formidable task. You can see where this is all heading. If the economy is global, regulation really needs to be global as well, or you're going to have international banditry, and you're going to have an increasingly unstable global economy, similar to what we had here in the late 20s, where there was no control on speculation. Alvin Toffler, the well-known futurist, in his recent book, Power Shift, says, old safety mechanisms designed to maintain financial stability in a world of relatively closed national economies are as obsolete as the Rust Belt world they were designed to protect. He says, globalized production and marketing require capital to flow easily across national boundaries. This, in turn, demands that the dismantling of old financial regulations and barriers erected by nations to protect their economies. And the nations are very willing to dismantle them, too, because they don't want to be left out. Modern ships, he says, are built with watertight compartments so that a leak in one part of the hull can't flood and sink the entire vessel. Liberalization of capital so that it can flow freely is the equivalent of eliminating these fail-safe compartments. It also threatens the power of one of the most important economic institutions of the industrial age, which is the central bank. And he's saying that economic failure in one country could easily spread and lead to a stampede today. It's precarious. The whole thing is like a big house of cards. Toffler says only a few years ago, the Bank of Japan, for instance, could influence the yen to dollar ratio by buying or selling $16 billion worth of yen. Today, with such sums are laughable. An estimated $200 billion worth of currencies are traded every day in London alone. In London, New York, and Tokyo alone. More than a trillion a week. Of this, no more than 10% is associated with world trade. The remaining 90% is pure speculation. Just money making money. Money coming to money. Toffler says, because power is rapidly shifting out of the hands of central bankers and the governments they nominally represent, we hear urgent calls for new, more centralized regulation at a supranational level. You can see the logic there very clearly. Toffler says this, the decades to come will therefore see a titanic power struggle between the globalizers and the nationalists over the nature of new regulatory institutions in the world capital markets. This struggle reflects the collision between a moribund industrial order and the new global system of wealth creation that's replacing it. So the Buchanans, the nationalizers, the people that want to say we ought to, you know, block the foreigners out of here and just keep our own money, are going to battle. There's going to be a lot of struggle between them and the globalizers, but the globalizers, look for the globalizers to win that one. Given the present state of the world, according to Barnett and Kavanaugh, the world urgently needs global political norms, global economic rules of conduct, a global legal order, and effective global authorities to undertake preventive diplomacy, the settlement of disputes. And they're saying that because of the present state of the world business, this is urgently needed. All this means that global banking has become highly dependent on a few centralized information operations to accomplish and monitor the transfers, and they detail the millions of transfers that go through key computer centers mainly in the U.S. and Europe. There's a crying need for political vision at the global level, but national leaders seem unable to take even small steps toward effective global action. They lament. As the world economy becomes more and more integrated, the process of political disintegration are accelerating. And there appears to be a direct connection between economic integration and political dissolution. This is a movement that is happening. You don't see it with your eyes, although people in the business community know all about it. And increasingly, what we used to view as our nation's economy and their nation's economy and the other nation's economy is just the economy of the world. By default, business enterprises are wielding political power in important ways. And they go on to explain, for instance, they say that economic ties across national borders have become so strong, so deep, and so complex that political leaders can no longer make successful use of traditional strategies to deal with such problems as unemployment, ecological deterioration, or the corrosive effects of chronic poverty. And they explain, for instance, how a president like Clinton will get elected on an economic incentive or stimulus package where he's going to use money to create jobs. And the international community will immediately assess this as bad for the bond, U.S. bonds, and they'll sell U.S. bonds, dropping the value and causing the U.S. government to have to go out and borrow money in the credit market in U.S. Interest rates climb. The stimulus effect on the economy is erased by essentially a veto by international monetary markets that say, to more or less falsely pumping up the economy. They're able to stop it. And the result is, where is the real power lying then, worldwide, in those marketplaces? Well, we're running out of time, so I wanted to just touch on the information revolution. Well, we could spend a whole night on this one alone. You know, this is the information age, and this is moving at such blinding speed, hardly anyone can keep up with the developments. Walter Wriston was the CEO for Citicorp, one of the biggest and the leaders in international banking, and an authority on the subject of the impact that information revolution's having worldwide. He says the massive amount of information that more move over the network, combined with the speed of the transmission, are transforming the way the world works in ways at least as profound as occurred in the Industrial Revolution. He says the pursuit of wealth is now largely the pursuit of information, and the application of information to the means of production. The sovereign's laws and regulations have not adjusted to the new reality. A person, for instance, with the skills to write a complex software program that can produce $1 billion of revenue, can walk past any customs officer with the world with nothing of value to declare. It's all in here. I'm not carrying anything in my suitcases. That's the way the information age is, and he calls this the twilight of sovereignty, that national sovereignty is now in its twilight and fading. He says an information economy also diminishes the rewards for control of territory and reduces the value of the resources that can be extracted through such control, like mining minerals or oil or agricultural products. These things still have a value, but what is much more valuable now is information. And that is not related to territory any longer. And so territorial boundaries are nowhere near as important as they used to be when land was the be-all and end-all in wealth. Wriston says, scientific knowledge is currently doubling about every 15 years. A fact, and I've read similar numbers from 15 to 25 years in several other authorities. Think about it. If you drew a point before which half of all of our discoveries lay before that point, and half of all of them lay after that point would only be 15 years ago, 1981. That's an incredible explosion of information. The information revolution leads to the twilight of sovereignty, he says, since the absolute power of the state to act alone, both internally against its own citizens and externally against other nations' affairs, is rapidly being attenuated. He points out, you know, nations can't keep secrets from their own people anymore. It used to be that they could keep an entire nation in darkness and not realizing that life could be different elsewhere. No longer possible. With satellite technology and a $1 transistor radio, people can find out what's happening everywhere. He says, we've learned that freedom is a virus for which there is no antidote. And that virus is spreading on the global electronic network to people in the far corners of the world who previously had no hope or knowledge of a better way of life. This process is in train, and it cannot be reversed since the technology upon which it's based will not go away. It's possible to reverse it. Revolutions, he says, are not made by gadgets, but by a shift in the balance of power. The underlying forces of the information revolution are causing such a shift in the balance of economic, political, and military power. Like when a system of national economies linked by government-regulated trade is replaced, at least in part, by an increasingly integrated global economy, beyond the reach of much national regulation, power changes hands at that point. When an international telecommunication system incorporating technologies from mobile phones to communication satellites deprives governments of the ability to keep secrets from the world or from their own people, power changes hands. Despite the power of a righteous market, until very recently, government retained substantial power to manipulate the value of their currencies. As the information revolution has rendered borders porous to huge volumes of high-speed information, it has deprived them of that power. They can no longer, you know, it used to be like Brazil used to just declare, our cruzados worth this much in terms of other economies. And it was a government decree. We just can't do that anymore in the world. No government can regulate the value of its currency because of the information revolution. As the screens light up with the latest statement of the president of the chairman of the Federal Reserves, traders make a judgment about the effect of the new policy on currency values, and they buy or sell accordingly, effectively vetoing that move. Moreover, in contrast to former international monetary systems, there's no way for a nation to resign from the information standard. You can't say, oh, we quit. No matter what political leaders do or say, the screens will continue to light up, traders will trade, and currency values will continue to be set not by the sovereign governments, but by global plebiscites. A plebiscite is like a vote by everybody. Everyone decides. The world can no longer be understood as a collection of national economies. The electronic infrastructure that now ties the world together, as well as great advances in the efficiency of conventional transportation, are creating a single global economy. This, then, is what I'm pointing to and suggesting to you, that as we look at a global economy, a global body of knowledge and information, a global culture, we are seeing incredible forces, and then the mandate of our ecological problems and our menace of warfare, incredible pressure toward a one-world solution. Wriston says, commerce and production are increasingly transnational. The very phrase international trade has begun to sound obsolete. As global business alliances grow and strengthen over time, it will become harder and harder for the politicians to unscramble the emerging global economy and reassert their declining power to regulate national life. The old political boundaries of nation states are being made obsolete by an alliance of commerce and technology. Political borders, long the cause of wars, are becoming porous. Commerce has not waited for the political process to adjust to technology, but instead has tended to drive it. They're no longer following after now, they're driving it. I brought, for those of you that are interested in more reading, I brought a copy of this entire outline and have put it back at the resource desk along with last week's outline. And so you can get copies of all of these citations along with bibliographical information. But since they're sort of lengthy, we're going to have to charge you 50 cents if you want a copy of those, either one of them. What's the bottom line today? Incredibly, the Bible's prediction that the whole world will unite is going to come true. That's the bottom line. And it's not going to be imposed on nations against their will. It's going to be something that the whole world is crying out for. The logic of one-worldism is just going to become irresistible, even though it costs national governments. They'll be pushed out of the way if they don't conform. This global unity will be liable, unfortunately, to takeover by a great totalitarian ruler. And it is one problem with centralizing everything. Is that when it's all tied to a central hub of control, that's ripe then for totalitarianism. And the Bible declares that this is exactly the danger that we will succumb to. Well, more on that later. Tonight, let's draw a couple of conclusions. First of all, knowledge that the future, that the world would move toward unification one day was impossible to have back in 33 AD. Or in 80 AD, let's say, or 90 when the book of Revelation was written. No more possible then. The world, this word, that the world would come to a time of unification is the product of the Lord of history, God himself. That's the conclusion you can draw. As we sit back and watch in the coming 10 and 20 years to see these forces crystallize and gain even greater force, we're going to see that the prospect of one-worldism, as outlandish and bizarre as that would have sounded 20 years ago, is going to seem like the most natural conclusion anyone could possibly reach. You're going to seem almost insane if you raise a voice against it. Here's another conclusion. People should come to the God of this word and get the rest of the story. Because as we unfold the rest of the prophetic scenario, we'll find that it all leads down to several very important personal and spiritual lessons. And I hope that I'm not going to be able to press this ahead that far tonight. And I know a lot of you have complained that when do we get the application? Not now. Okay, first we need to understand what it is we're talking about, then we can talk about how it applies to our lives. So, relax. And this is not a McDonald's version. That we may have to actually put some work in here to get to that point. So it is coming, though, and I hope you'll keep studying with us. Before we take questions tonight, I remind you of the handouts in back. We are going to have to charge you for the labor and materials in those 50 cents each. That's at cost. Give you a chance to give if you want to share in the expenses of our fellowship here. I'm not asking you to give if you're a guest here tonight. I want to remind you of the Summer Apologetics Institute once again. We're opening registration and the registrations are beginning to flood in. Get yours. We do have the brochures here tonight. We ran out last week. They're here. Get it. Fill it out. If you delay, probably someone else will have your seat. William Lane Craig will be here on the 23rd of July. Make that a note on your calendar to get here early that night, because there will probably be no seats available in here that night. Also, the American Cities Grassroots Campaign is an opportunity to hear John Perkins, who is a great leader in the black community today for reconciliation, Christ's way, racial reconciliation. He is one of the greatest speakers and leaders. I think he's the greatest leader in the black church today. And he's coming here to speak Friday night, June 28th. We're going to take our group up here and listen, because we meet on Friday night, our home group, and we're coming up. And I hope that everyone will do that. Last time he came, people were talking about it for weeks afterwards. Very exciting and powerful speaker. You have a free book tonight, if you're a guest here, that will unfold some of this material about the prophetic word and also explain why you should consider the truth claims of Christ in a personal relationship with him. You can get it by going to the welcome booth, telling them you want the free book, fill out a coupon, they'll give it to you. If you'd like to come up and talk to me or one of the teaching team about your questions tonight, we'll be hanging around here and we're happy to talk. All right, do we have any comments or questions? Yes. It does seem like racism is almost on the rise. At the same time that we see people coming together worldwide economically and information-wise, and we see new problems with racism, I believe that we will see these racial divisions breaking down. People are going to be willing to come together, basically, not because they love one another so much, but for sheer self-interest. It's just going to be catastrophic if you don't join in and you're left out. And I think it's that the weight of that is gradually going to outweigh all local or ethnic considerations, and it's just going to become the dominant factor. And so that's how it's going to happen, I think. I guess we have time maybe for one more. Yes. Are these good things that have happened? Are these things that God caused to happen? You know, the prophetic word often prophesies and predicts events that happen that are not good. Many events that are predicted in the Bible are actually catastrophes that are on the way, as we shall see. It doesn't mean that it's God's will, but God, being an omniscient being, being an eternal being who's not in the bounds of time the way we are, is able to know the future with certainty. And I think that whether the things that are predicted are good or bad have to be determined on the basis, you know, of ethical study of what's right and wrong, not just on the fact that they're predicted. Some of these things are harmless, and some of them are very dangerous. We can't draw conclusions on that one way or the other. One worldism really is a great idea. I mean, after all, Christ himself is in favor of one worldism, and when he takes over as King Messiah, we'll have one worldism permanently. But the problem of trying to have one worldism without Christ, the human race forming a unity without the God who created them, that's going to be the problem right there. Well, we'll study that more next week. Why don't we turn to God in closing? Lord, you've told us what the future holds, and we remember Jesus' sayings, "Behold, I've told you everything in advance." As we see the various strains of modern history moving in the direction that you said they would, key things like the regathering of Israel that are unmistakable, and then these other trends too, going against everything that we would have expected, everything that common sense would have claimed even 15, 20, and 30 years ago, It's amazing, God, and we realize that your word is very important. We realize that you've given us this information, and not just for our curiosity, but so that we will understand the great truths behind it, namely your grace and your desire to give us personal relationship and eternal life. We thank you for that. In Christ's name, amen.